Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. Eastern Kentucky has recently added devastating flooding to its list of persistent economic and social challenges. In this episode, Alan Maiman, a journalist who spent 5 years reporting on Hazard, Kentucky and its environs, and married the daughter of a Harlan County coal miner, describes the region's decades-long struggle to move past a decimated coal industry, which left behind a shattered economy, faced with persistent health issues, and beset by drug abuse and bitter political rivalries. Alan Maiman, your book, Twilight and Hazard, An Appalachian Reckoning, came out in paperback this summer, and just shortly after its release, Hazard, Kentucky, the community you write about, was in the national news because of historic levels of flooding. I want to start by showing our audience a national news report on that situation. Let's watch.
Rain sweeping across Kentucky, battering the same neighborhoods already destroyed by catastrophic flash flooding.
This region has been hit harder than any of us have ever seen, maybe harder than any of us thought was possible.
Homes and businesses washed away, hundreds now living in shelters, dozens still missing.
There are whole areas of the ground that there's concrete, but there's nothing on top of that concrete. Those were foundations to homes that were literally swept away by what was a creek is now this rushing river that's going through this area. The people who live here in this town, they tell me they've never had flooding here before. This is not in a flood zone. And some of these houses had 7 feet plus of water. The property that I'm currently standing on right now, the man told me that he rescued several of his neighbors using his excavator, neighbors that were trapped in trees, that were up on light poles.
Alan Maiman, ultimately 39 people estimated dead in that flooding. This is on top of 2.5 years of the pandemic. And in a region that has been economically challenged for a long time. What's the likely impact of all this?
Yeah, Susan, I mean, those images are just heartbreaking. And yeah, the flooding could not have come at a worse time for a region that has been working hard to broaden its economic base trying to overcome some of the generational challenges it's faced. In terms of moving past coal into something a little more diversified. So the shock of this is still very much with the people of the region. The unbelievable devastation I covered during my time as a reporter in Eastern Kentucky, a lot of catastrophic floods that were referred to as thousand-year floods. But nothing that compares to this one. I will say this, that in the aftermath of the flooding, the way in which these communities have come together to clean up, but also to look ahead is very inspiring. And I think one can hope that out of this, the region will come with a renewed sense of purpose and determination in terms of moving forward. The resiliency that the region has shown in the wake of this has been amazingly impressive.
How did you come to write a book about Hazard, Kentucky?
I was the Eastern Kentucky bureau chief for the Louisville Courier-Journal from 2000 to 2006. I was based in Hazard, Kentucky, hence the title of the book, Twilight in Hazard, but I covered 30 Eastern Kentucky counties. Most of my coverage, however, focused on southeastern Kentucky, what we may refer to as the core coal counties of eastern Kentucky. And I happened to be covering the region at a particularly consequential time across the board. I was in eastern Kentucky when the prescription drug epidemic hit hardest. I was there when political winds started shifting in a way that we are still grappling with today. And even after I left the region as a reporter, because I married the daughter of a Harlan County coal miner, I maintained a connection to the area. So the time came where I realized, you know what, this is a book 15 years in the making, and I really want to try to connect dots in a meaningful way and try to convey to readers what I have seen in this region, what I experienced in this region as a reporter, in a way that hopefully will give readers a better, more thorough understanding of this place.
Why do you think people around the rest of the country would be interested in what happens in eastern Kentucky?
I think there's a popular perception about the region that has, you know, I quote something in my book, newspaper clippings from the 19th century, very disparaging viewpoints of the mountains of eastern Kentucky. And clearly the mass media perceptions of Appalachian Kentucky have not been kind. So I think it's a place that has a place in popular imagination. I don't, however, feel like the understanding is thorough enough. I think it's based a lot of times on old, tired tropes and stereotypes. Now, the 2016 presidential election was certainly an impetus for me to sit down and write Twilight and Hazard, because in the aftermath of Donald Trump's victory in 2016, national reporters from around the country flocked to eastern Kentucky, kind of labeling it as Trump country, and did all sorts of newspaper and magazine stories with datelines, Hazard, Harlan, Pikeville, basically operating on a false assumption that these areas had been Democratic up until that point, but because of Donald Trump shifted into the Republican camp. I wanted to debunk that because that's simply not true. So I think it was important in terms of debunking a lot of half truths that people may be walking around with, and a lot of them have to do with sort of the national political landscape that I know is something that especially since 2016 has been on everybody's mind.
Some reviewers are describing your book as a rebuttal to J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. Do you see it as that?
I devote probably three quarters of a page of the book to J.D. Vance and Hillbilly Elegy, but you're correct. There was one reviewer who said, "I eviscerate Hillbilly Elegy with stiletto precision." That my book is not a direct response to Hillbilly Elegy. My book is an attempt to bring substance to the topic, something that I feel maybe lacking in Hillbilly Elegy. I recently wrote an opinion piece for the Cleveland Plain Dealer in which I call out J.D. Vance. For those of you who have read Hillbilly Elegy, he reflects with great pride on his ancestral home of Breathitt County, Kentucky, which was one of the counties that I covered. Breathitt County, Kentucky, along with Knott County and Perry County and Letcher County, that was one of the counties hit hardest by these recent floods. There wasn't a single public pronouncement from J.D. Vance expressing anything about these floods. And I thought, wow, that, you know, as much as I started to view Hillbilly Elegy as a book about J.D. Vance and not about the region, his conspicuous silence on the catastrophic flooding that took place in his ancestral home, I think kind of gave me further reason to believe that J.D. Vance is more about J.D. Vance than giving people a complex understanding of a region.
If the perceptions of the region are based on some stereotypes and, as you call them, tired tropes, what are the realities of the region? Tell me about the size of the population, its demographics, and what the economic conditions are like.
Sure. So the 30 counties I covered combined have a population of approximately 500,000, but it's a large geographic area. The sort of the nerve centers of southeastern Kentucky, Hazard, Harlan, Pikeville, these are all towns of approximately 5,000 people. Eastern Kentucky is predominantly white. However, there are pockets of eastern Kentucky that are quite diverse, and this is a legacy of coal mining at the turn of the 20th century, when the first seam of coal was mined in eastern Kentucky. And in the years that followed, people flocked from not only all over the country, but all over the world to work in the coal mines. And to this day, there are still pockets of diversity in parts of eastern Kentucky. But for the most part, it's a largely homogeneous white area. And of course, if you're talking about demographics, the generational poverty of the region is an unavoidable topic. I don't dwell on it in the book. I cite a couple of statistics to kind of just illustrate it, but dwelling on it, I don't think there are enough pages to devote to why and how and what how that can change for me to dwell too much on facts and figures and statistics, which do paint a fairly bleak picture of the region. Appalachia as a region lags behind the rest of the country when it comes to almost every socioeconomic measurement. Eastern Kentucky lags behind the rest of Appalachia. So we're talking about the region of Appalachia that from a socioeconomic standpoint has generationally struggled the most.
Fortune magazine just a couple years ago did an economic story on the region, and they also had video with it. And I have a clip that's about half a minute long about an Eastern Kentucky coal miner talking about how his community changed after coal declined.
When I was a kid, the playgrounds and the streets were full. I mean, we had two country clubs that had swimming pools, that both had golf courses, had tons of members, you know, all due to the coal industry. And then today, there's no downtown businesses, two local convenience stores, three or four places to eat out. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, the homes are falling down because they've been vacant for so long. The communities, you know, look bad. And there's no jobs there.
What has been the challenge of attracting good jobs to the region?
Well, coal epitomizes the boom and bust, and I believe that interview really spells it out nicely. That you know, there were years and even whole entire decades where coal was booming and things in Eastern Kentucky were relatively prosperous for many people. Only to have the industry fall on hard times and for there to be real struggles. So the challenges of moving past coal are not only that the industry has had a stranglehold on the region for more than a century. The real challenge is now that coal is on the decline, and you can just look at coal production, coal employment. It paints a very vivid picture of the fact that coal isn't coming back. However, because coal is so deeply ingrained in the heritage and the culture and the identity of the region, it's difficult to turn the page. And coal still has a seat at the table when it comes to economic development issues and community issues as a whole. So the idea of trying to create a patchwork economy in Eastern Kentucky in which the region isn't dependent on a single industry, that way of thinking has gained some momentum in recent years. When I was covering the region 15 or 20 years ago, I felt like these conversations were more lip service and not really happening in a serious manner. But what I've seen in the past few years is a much more serious, forward-thinking way of approaching a patchwork way of creating a more robust, diversified economy. But the coal industry still looms. This coal industry is still very much a part of the ethos of the area, and that is something that has to be grappled with.
So let's go back to presidential politics for a bit again. In 2016, we heard a lot from especially the candidate Trump about the coal industry and the need to revitalize it. By 2020, not so much. Why is that?
The coal jobs did not come back. Coal production did not increase as Donald Trump had promised it would. That didn't make the voters of Eastern Kentucky any less loyal to Donald Trump in 2020 than they had been in 2016, which is certainly a very interesting phenomenon. But I think it's important to note that the 85% approximately of the voters who voted for Donald Trump in both 2016 and 2020, that's not much higher than the percentage that voted for Mitt Romney in 2012 and John McCain in 2008. 2000 was really the last time that there was any meaningful patch of blue in eastern Kentucky. And there's been a slow movement in, to where we are now, where eastern Kentucky is one of the reddest regions in the country, even though the promises on coal were not delivered.
How was Hillary Clinton's comments about deplorables received in the area?
I think that the deplorables comment certainly resonated in eastern Kentucky, but there was another comment that she made that resonated even more. And in retrospect, it couldn't have been more of a tone-deaf comment. She said that in touting a green energy plan, that we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of work. She went on to put that into context and articulate it in a way that softened her statement, but boy, did that create a soundbite for the that really set the tone for the entire election. We are going to put a lot of coal miners out of work. That was just really not keeping in mind how important coal mining is to the culture, heritage, and legacy of the region, and made Hillary Clinton the perfect foil in 2016.
When you were reporting 20 years ago and forward, as the coal industry declined, you also write about the rise of the drug industry, illicit drugs, and unfortunately drug abuse in the region. At the time, OxyContin was a big, big issue. And as you say, it's been supplanted by methadone, then fentanyl, and now heroin. But I was really taken by the story that you told, is that we learned that Purdue Pharma would actually target regions like eastern Kentucky because of worker injuries as a right place to introduce their products. Can you talk about how that drug abuse got really took root and how it's impacted the region?
Sure. Yeah, places like rural Maine and rural eastern Kentucky, where most of the work is literally backbreaking work, Purdue Pharma saw an opportunity to market this drug that it touted as a wonder drug for pain. And southeastern Kentucky in particular was a real focal point for their marketing efforts. And it wasn't only Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma, because its drug is OxyContin, absolutely contributed to saturating the streets with the drug by targeting doctors and trying to convince doctors that OxyContin was a drug that they could prescribe not only for people in pain because they have cancer or because they have a back-breaking injury, but you know what? Maybe you could prescribe it to a patient who has a toothache. Doctors many doctors were complicit in this as well. Some overzealously, others criminally overprescribed the drug, and all it really took to devastate one community was for one doctor to overprescribe OxyContin and other powerful prescription painkillers, because they quickly ended up on the street. And next thing you know, pretty much every family in one way, shape, or form is touched by this epidemic. And I had barely unpacked my bags when I arrived in eastern Kentucky when the first public pronouncement of this new drug, OxyContin, was made by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Lexington, Kentucky. So for the entirety of the 5+ years that I spent covering the region every day, the prescription drug epidemic was absolutely a major part of my coverage, because it filtered out and impacted every other story that I did.
As you make the point in the book that all roads lead back to the economic realities to the region, and in terms of illicit drugs, you write that in the absence of traditional economic engines found elsewhere, the illegal drug trade fills a void in the economy. What's been the impact on families?
Well, the impact on families has been heartbreaking. It's touched my own extended family, as it's touched almost every family in the region. And one of the things that took a huge problem and made it even worse was the lack of treatment facilities in eastern Kentucky. When this problem reached its peak, people who got to the point where they realized they needed help did not have anywhere to go for help. So it damaged at least a generation. It affected the workforce. It it added to something I write about in the book, which I think is very important, which is the generational trauma that exists in Eastern Kentucky. It just took a region that was already hurting and kicked it when it was already down. And it still resonates today. The drugs of choice have changed, but the area is still trying to get clean. And it started with OxyContin in many ways.
It is a national problem. Are the statistics in Eastern Kentucky any worse than around the rest of the country?
Overdose deaths, fortunately, started to decline in around 2015. But I think what we've seen in Eastern Kentucky is the same thing as we've seen in a lot of countries during the pandemic shutdown. Drug overdose deaths everywhere increased, and the same can be said for Eastern Kentucky when from that sort of spring of 2020 to through 2021, those numbers started to spike again.
Readers of your book will get a brief history of coal over the past 120 years. I found it interesting to learn more. Four distinct periods of time for coal. The last, of course, is the rapid decline in the 21st century. But you start by telling us that the whole economy really was based on landowners in the early 1900s being swindled out of their mineral rights. What's that history?
Well, the term broad form deeds is a very important concept to understand when you're talking about coal mining in Eastern Kentucky. Basically, coal companies, many from out of state, coming in and convincing landowners to basically sell the rights to the land underneath where they stood. In some cases, paying very, very little for those rights. Part of the suspicion of outsiders that exists to this day in Eastern Kentucky goes back over 100 years to when big out-of-state corporations came in and were able to snap up the coal rights and were able to get the wealth from those the mining rights and that it didn't go back into the people of the community. So that's a really important thing to understand when you're talking about the history of coal mining. And then on into the unionization of coal mines and the coal camps. And the coal has been the straw that stirs the drink for over 100 years. So it's really imperative to understand that history. And I do it as briefly as possible as I can in the book, but I really think it's important to hit those most important marks to understand how in 2022, we're still talking about and thinking about that first seam of coal that was mined back in 1900, that the legacy of that still is very much with us today.
Would you talk a little bit about coal camps, which you write that disappeared by the 1950s, but they remain part of the history and identity of Eastern Kentucky, and it transformed the society there. How so?
Yeah, coal camps were communities owned by coal companies and houses built by coal companies that the workforce lived in. There were company schools, there were company stores, and at these company stores, you didn't pay in dollars and cents, you paid in what was called scrip. So coal camps had their own currency. So it was a very controlled environment. Some people, some older people who have memories of growing up in coal camps, look back at that time with some affections, with some nostalgia. Others kind of see it for what it was, which was kind of an indentured servitude of sorts, where the coal company owned the town and in many ways owned the people in the town.
What about the role of the United Mine Workers? How powerful are they today?
Today, they're non-existent. The last union coal mine in Kentucky closed back when I was covering the region back in the early 2000s. And that was a coal mine, a surface coal mine in Western Kentucky. That wasn't even a coal mine in Eastern Kentucky. But for the decades that the union was strong, it was extremely strong. I write in the book about how it was common in many Eastern Kentucky households to see three portraits on the walls of houses. There was John F. Kennedy, there was John L. Lewis, who was head of the mine union, and there was Jesus. So those were the three most admired entities back in the 50s and the 60s when the union was king. Slowly but surely over time, we've seen a decline in the unions to the point where they are now non-existent. But the reason that many Eastern Kentucky counties to this day remain primarily registered Democrat, that is a legacy of the time when the mining union was most powerful, because it was aligned with the Democratic Party. So political affiliation has been sort of passed down from generation to generation, kind of like an inheritance. So even though you see many registered Democrats in Eastern Kentucky, many of those folks, their voting habits these days are very much aligned with the Republican Party, even though they're still registered Democrats. That goes back to when the UMWA was at its strongest.
When did strip mining become popular?
Well, when the underground seams of coal started to become depleted, strip mining, we're talking sort of early 60s when it really came into its own. And it was obviously its legacy is still being felt today. We can look at the recent catastrophic flooding in Eastern Kentucky and ask to what extent strip mining exacerbated that problem. When you blow off the top of mountains, when you strip hillsides of foliage, and you have a 10-inch rainfall, that rain has nowhere to drain. That rain is going to just come pouring off the hillsides. But strip mining became a force in the early 1960s. Most mining that still takes place today is strip mining. Not all strip mining is mountaintop removal mining, but much of it is, and that certainly has scarred the landscape in invisible ways, but also in ways that we only see come to the fore when we have flooding like we just had.
If coal mining peaked, as you write, in 1948 at 75,000 workers, how many people in Eastern Kentucky are employed in the mines today or in the coal industry?
I read something the other day, just a couple thousand, I think 3,000 to 5,000. So, you know, not very many people. Part of that, of course, is that strip mining relies more on automation, so you can mine the coal with fewer people. But coal mining, in terms of being an employer, it's fairly negligible, especially if you compare it to the number of people that are employed by school districts, hospitals, city governments. Coal mining, although it employs relatively few people these days, really still carries a clout that you wouldn't expect an industry to carry when it only employs a few thousand people.
One of the residuals, of course, of pit mining is black lung disease. It's something that people have heard of before. What is the situation with it now, since most of the mining is strip mining? How many people suffer from it, and what is the federal program that helps those with black lung disease?
Right. I think it's important to note most people associate black lung disease with underground coal mining, but there are a lot of miners who work on the surface who are still breathing in very harmful dust particles who contract black lung. My father-in-law died from black lung in 2003, and I got to see kind of up close and personally this heartbreaking descent. He, like a lot of miners who were taking their last breaths, would say things like, you know what, all I want to do is get back in the mines. I would love to be able to go back in the mines one more time. Again, just emphasizing how important to the culture, heritage, and identity coal mining is, that miners who basically had given their lives to this job, all they wanted to do was go back and work in coal mining one more time. I read recently that incidences of black lung, now there are fewer miners working now, so the overall numbers have gone down, but in terms of percentage of miners being diagnosed with black lung, that number remains quite high, and the federal government hasn't really done as much as it could to make sure that these former miners who are dying of black lung get the benefits that they deserve. And that's been an ongoing ever since I was there, at least 20 years of how can we make these miners whole who gave their lives working in the mines. And there certainly needs to be more done on the federal level to make sure that happens.
Talking with Alan Maiman about Eastern Kentucky, in particular Hazard, Kentucky, where he was based as a reporter in the 20 years ago and now is married into the region and continues to go back and has written a book about the challenges and opportunities there. Alan, the next area, and we will get to solutions and the way forward, but really a lot of your book is outlining the big challenges that the region has. And the next one I wanted to talk about was public corruption. You write that poverty has its consequences, and one is corrupt and chaotic local government. How does this play out locally?
There was a recent study that of all the federal judicial districts in the country, that the one covering Eastern Kentucky had among the highest number of public corruption cases over a two-decade period. So clearly there is a problem, or has been a problem, in Eastern Kentucky with public corruption. It really came to a head in 2002 when I was covering the region. This was at the peak of the prescription drug epidemic. And what we saw in 2002 was the prescription drug epidemic meeting public corruption, meeting political violence. In 2002, a sheriff's candidate was assassinated, as well as an incumbent sheriff. And as the authorities unpacked the conspiracies behind these deaths, they realized that that they could trace it all back to control of the drug trade in those counties. So fortunately, since 2002, we have not seen that level of political violence. But it is crucial that these struggling counties in Eastern Kentucky have competent and honest and forward-thinking local leadership. Because as I say in the book, there are places that can manage when there's a little graft, a little bit of graft. If you have an otherwise healthy and robust economy, you can cope with that. It's not a good thing, but you can withstand it. That's not really the case in a place like Eastern Kentucky, where one corrupt public official can set the area back many years.
Well, speaking of corruption, you've got quite the story about disability enrollments, SSI disability, and an amazing statistic in a report done for the government. During the period of time studied, the state population had grown by 20%, while disability enrollment grew by 241%. And for many, disability checks are a primary source of income. You've got an amazing story of Eric Kahn in this, and we can't spend too much time on it, but ultimately he swindled the government out of approximately $600 million in fraudulent Social Security claims. How did he get away with that?
Eric Kahn is a microcosm in some ways of exactly what I was just talking about, in terms of how a handful of people with corrupt intent can create absolute chaos. So very briefly, the Eric Kahn situation stemmed from Eric Kahn, a Social Security disability lawyer, the preeminent Social Security disability lawyer in the area, colluding with a federal judge, a federal administrative judge, and doctors to file fraudulent SSI claims on behalf of thousands of people in Eastern Kentucky. This is not to say that those thousands of people did not have legitimate claims to SSI or SSDI, but the claims were made in a way that amounted to a sham. And if you added up all of the awards granted to these people, that you come up with the close to $600 million that you just cited. So the important thing to take from the most important thing to take from that story to me, it goes back to what I was saying a moment ago about generational trauma. There is a lot of chronic depression and anxiety disorder in Eastern Kentucky. And that is why we have seen such a spike in the number of people receiving supplemental security income or SSDI. That's not in and of itself the problem. That's a symptom of the larger problems and challenges that I write about in the book. But Eric Kahn, who had corrupt intent and is now serving a lengthy federal prison sentence because he was caught for what he did, really in some ways exemplifies how one bad person can create a chaotic sequence of events for people who, by the way, are still trying to get those benefits that the government claims they were fraudulently granted They have made it very difficult for those people to go back and prove that they actually deserve them.
You say that there are law school students who are helping to work their way through more than 3,000 cases.
That's right. I believe Notre Dame Law School has and Vanderbilt Law School, because there are thousands of people who are trying to get, and we're not talking about an exorbitant amount of income. We're talking about a few hundred dollars a month in supplemental security income. And one thing that resonated with me, there were people, including in the halls of Congress, who said, oh, well, it wasn't just Eric Kahn and the doctors and the judge that created this problem. It was the people who knew that they didn't deserve these awards, and they were in on it. Well, there were multiple suicides after the federal government cut off the awards to people who had been Eric Kahn clients, clearly indicating that depression and anxiety, clinical in both of these things, is a real thing. There's been an amazing pro bono effort on behalf of these clients to try to get those awards restored.
Last topic I wanted to hit on before we talk about ways forward is the role of religion. Across the country, participation in religion seems to be declining. What's the situation in Eastern Kentucky?
Well, when I write about the peculiar electoral politics of Eastern Kentucky, I highlight religion as part of that. I think that if you want to talk about the shift from support of the national Democrats to where we are today with seeing one of the reddest regions in the country, one of the reasons for that is the rise of the religious right. That there's no question, and I believe that started in a big way with 9/11. I think God and country became a really big theme in Eastern Kentucky after the attacks of 9/11. So you combine sort of the rise of the religious right with people like Franklin Graham and people like Jerry Falwell Jr. And you combine that with the way in which the coal industry kind of has replaced the coal mining union as the quote unquote friend of the coal miner. You take those two things and you put them together. I think that goes a really long way towards explaining why in 2000 you had Al Gore winning a lot of southeastern Kentucky counties, to the point where 2004 onward, there was not a patch of blue anywhere to be found in southeastern Kentucky.
So let's talk. We have about 20 minutes left about the way forward. First of all, worrying about poverty in the Appalachian region has been a longstanding topic for the federal government. President Kennedy was the one who created the Appalachian Regional Commission. It launched in 1965. LBJ followed with his war on poverty. I went on the website for the Regional Commission, and they say that since 65, the ARC has invested $4.5 billion in approximately 28,000 economic development projects across Appalachia and attracting over $10 billion additional in matching funds. On top of that, President Biden's stimulus proposal budgeted $5.3 billion in direct aid to local governments in the Appalachian region. And one of the commission's co-chairs is also quoted as saying that Biden's proposed American Jobs Plan provides $1 billion in infrastructure repair to distressed community. That's a lot of federal money going that way over decades. Has it had any impact? Why are we still talking about persistent poverty with all this attention from the federal government?
Well, one program that was done away with of recent vintage was the child tax credit that Joe Manchin sort of put the kibosh on as the deciding vote, about a year ago. That program, the child tax credit, did more to lift families out of poverty than any program had in the history of the federal government, and that went away overnight. So yeah, the federal government programs have had an impact, and you see that the infrastructure of Eastern Kentucky certainly benefited in some ways from legislation that commenced in 1965 and has carried through till today. I think that what's really important as we sit here today is to talk about how Build Back Better, which was once just a catchphrase, needs to be a reality in the wake of these floods in Eastern Kentucky. Eastern Kentucky absolutely must build back better after these floods, and these various sources of federal income, there's reason for hope that can make a difference. State government has a role to play, as does local government. But the fourth sort of leg of that table is local community efforts, nonprofits, foundations, who in many cases will be the stewards of those funds. And again, forward-thinking, bright people making those decisions will go a long way towards making sure that all of that money gets put into good sources. There has been talk about doing a Marshall Plan for coal country. I think that's an idea that deserves some attention. Although all of the programs you just cited, I think if you piece them together, you almost have a quasi Marshall Plan for coal country. It just has to be, the funds just have to be spent well, and not directed to no bid contracts or other historic sources of graft, and just make sure that money goes to the right places, and that could make a difference.
Eastern Kentucky has some powerful representation in Congress. One person that makes a regular appearance in your book is Congressman Hal Rogers, who is now the Dean of the House, the longest serving member of Congress. What has been his role in directing federal funds to the region?
Hal Rogers is a 21-term congressman. He has gained the nickname the Prince of Pork back when he was head of the Appropriations Committee. He did steer a lot of money towards Eastern Kentucky, particularly towards the Pulaski County and its county seat of Somerset, which is his hometown, in which he had great ambitions to sort of build a technology, high-tech corridor in Eastern Kentucky. And that has... that hasn't really flourished, that idea of creating a what he referred to as a Silicon Holler. But no, he has steered a lot of money towards Eastern Kentucky and has maintained a lot of clout in the House. I will say that he was a leading voice during the prescription drug epidemic. He spoke truth to power when it was desperately needed. I don't feel like he's been as responsive and vocal as he could be on coal-related issues. But when it's come to prescription drug abuse, he was willing to lay it out in a way that I think was very helpful to his constituency.
Of course, in the Senate, longtime Republican leader Mitch McConnell is a Kentuckian. What's been his attitude towards Eastern Kentucky's problems?
Well, starting, let's say, in 2008, when Barack Obama ran for president, and the red wave just took over Eastern Kentucky. Mitch McConnell, ever the political chess master. I mean, say what you want about the man, but this guy knows politics and plays the political game extremely well. To me, he realized that he's going to get votes in Eastern Kentucky, regardless of how many times he goes there or how often he advocates for issues of importance to the region. So to me, the story of Mitch McConnell in Eastern Kentucky is largely of not really spending too much time there or caring very much about the issues there, but still reaping the benefits on Election Day. So it's a very interesting phenomenon.
And would you say a word about Senator Rand Paul, the other Kentucky senator?
Yeah, Rand Paul. Coming up in November, we have a very interesting Senate election in Kentucky. Rand Paul is going up against a Louisville former state House member named Charles Booker, whose campaign motto is "From the Hood to the Holler." He's trying to make the point that some of the problems that most impact people in urban Louisville can very, very much apply to the challenges and struggles experienced in places like Eastern Kentucky. So that's a really interesting Senate race. Rand Paul took office after I stopped covering the region on a full-time basis. Jim Bunning was the other U.S. senator when I was there. But again, I relate this anecdote in the book. The only time I saw Kentucky's two U.S. senators and Hal Rogers together at an event. It wasn't at an event about prescription drug abuse. It wasn't at an event about mountaintop removal. It was at the groundbreaking for a coal-fired power plant that actually ended up never getting built in the first place. So I feel like these politicians' responsiveness to the future of Eastern Kentucky has been lacking in many ways. It'll be interesting to see what happens in November with the when Senator Paul goes up against Charles Booker. We'll see if Charles Booker can get some traction in places like Eastern Kentucky.
In terms of attracting sustainable jobs other than in the coal industry, what is the success rate of either federal or state tax incentives in bringing companies to the region and having them stay?
There's not a great legacy of that. The one example that I cite in the book, because it was so highly touted to the point where President Bill Clinton came to Hazard, Kentucky on July 4th, 1999, and he stood on Main Street and he announced the imminent arrival of a new high-tech call center run by a company called Sykes Enterprises, a technical support call center that was going to generate hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs. Well, companies like Sykes came in, took advantage of the tax incentives that attracted them to the area, and once those tax incentives were gone, moved elsewhere. So there's a checkered history for those programs. And so for me, the answer really comes more from within. I think that it's important to recognize that Eastern Kentucky's greatest resource is not its coal, but its people. And I think that creating a future for Eastern Kentucky in which outsiders want to come and visit and companies want to locate, and most importantly, young people in the region want to stay and become entrepreneurs, is really the key to moving forward. Not these fly-by-night companies coming in, setting up shop for a little while, and then bailing when it doesn't make financial sense for them to stay.
Of course, companies need educated workforce. What are the statistics about the achievement level of the secondary and primary schools in the region?
It's been getting better in terms of high school graduation rates, college graduation rates, getting better, but still not only lags behind the rest of Appalachia, lags behind the rest of central Appalachia, Southwest Virginia, Northeast Tennessee, still an issue, partly because of access to higher education. Again, it's gotten a little bit better. Eastern Kentucky University now has a full-fledged campus in Manchester, Kentucky, which is in Clay County, which is in southeastern Kentucky. So that's certainly part of the equation. I mean, I've talked to economic development officials in the region who say, wow, you know, our job is really hard, because when we go out and talk to CEOs and try to convince them to set up shop in this region, they want to know about quality of life across the board, and schools are obviously a major part of that for CEOs who are, you know, considering the idea of moving to southeastern Kentucky.
One of the things you say, it needs a well-coordinated plan geared towards physical and technological infrastructure, private and public money. But you also cited earlier that there's been some new energy in the region. One of the things we found on YouTube was a video done by the city of Hazard in 2020, and it was done for a contest for development money from HGTV, the television network. We pulled a clip for it because it demonstrates that enthusiasm and energy that you're talking about. Let's watch this.
So Hazard is a city of about 5,000 people nestled in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains of eastern Kentucky. And our downtown boasts a lot of history, including visits by Robert Kennedy, President Bill Clinton, and a feud called the French Eversole War, a family feud which claimed more life than the Hatfields and McCoys. In addition to historic events, we also have boast some beautiful historic buildings that have been around for over 100 years. Hazard used to be a booming coal town with thriving downtown businesses.
Urban sprawl, changing economy, decreasing population, all these things really left our downtown in pretty rough shape.
We have been fighting back recently. We've passed downtown incentive programs to bring businesses back. We've upped our code enforcement against blighted buildings, and we've hosted new events such as an Oktoberfest and a downtown music festival.
And it's helped, it really has. But there's still a lot more to do.
Alan Maiman, of course, all of that before the pandemic and before this flood that we talked about at the beginning. So where does that regional and hazard-based energy go from here?
Well, I hope, again, that out of the catastrophic flooding comes a renewed sense of purpose and determination. And there are hopeful signs of that. The way in which the communities have come together to clean up could certainly extend past that to where this can be a rallying cry for picking back up with the work that was really starting to happen in earnest prior to the flooding and prior to the pandemic shutdown. But I mean, I love that video because I think it really speaks to what we are seeing now, that it is a new energy and new voices and thinking out of the box. And I think downtown revitalization in towns like Hazard and Harlan are an extremely important part of this jigsaw puzzle that needs to be pieced together in order to say, okay, you know what? The post-coal economy is fully underway. So yeah, it's my hope that the work on that can resume again very soon. And there are, the reason I wrote an afterword to the book that for the paperback version of the book is that I wanted to more clearly convey the ideas of hope and redemption that do exist in the region. I do spend a lot of time in the book talking about the historic challenges and the institutional neglect that I believe has resulted in these challenges, but there certainly is a good bit of hope and redemption happening now.
I wanted to ask you about that addendum that you put on, because you write in the book that from the hood to the holler, America's faces a reckoning with poverty. And we also have to combat the notion that people and places are irredeemable. After your book was published in hardcover, what kind of conversations happened that you recounted in the afterword?
Well, one notable conversation occurred on Main Street in Hazard at a beautiful new art center on Main Street. That was by far the toughest crowd I've encountered when talking about the book. This audience was largely comprised of city officials who were working hard to come up with answers. So we had a great conversation. I would have been really surprised and disappointed if the book didn't generate conversation like the one that I had in Downtown Hazard. But every conversation I've had, including this one, I just think is a way to kind of get people thinking not only about Southeastern Kentucky, but how it applies to other places in America that in so many ways have been left behind and shouldn't be viewed as irredeemable. We need to confront as Americans who we are as a country and what we value.
Even though you married into Hazard, what was the view of the locals about the story you told about them?
Yeah, my wife is from Harlan County, USA, so over a couple mountains from Hazard. But there's a lot in the book. I think I cover a lot of ground in the book. And if somebody reads the book and says, you know what, I agree with 100% everything you said, that would be surprising to me. There's a lot in there to unpack and to discuss and to even argue about. It's all based on stories I covered, so I really ground it in the journalism of the time that I was there every day, and in the past 15 years, as I've been visiting the area as an observer. But I think the feedback has been overall really great. The people who have challenged me on this point or another point have really helped me work through some of the things that I continue to work through, because I don't claim to have all the answers. And having these conversations really helps me process all of this information, because we all sort of have a common goal, which is how can a brighter future be created for the region?
Why did you decide on the name Twilight in Hazard?
Right. I think that was a bone of contention for some people who thought that a new day had already dawned in Hazard. So why wasn't the book called Sunrise in Hazard or Dawn in Hazard? And I answered that question very directly by saying, look, I feel like some really good things are happening here, but the area just isn't there yet. You can't overcome 120 years of of institutional neglect. I'll use that phrase again. You can't overcome that in just a few years. So twilight, I liked the word twilight because obviously there are two twilights during the course of a day, one right before sundown and one right before sunset. And I kind of wanted to leave it to the readers to decide where on the sunrise, sunset spectrum they feel we are.
Our audience is an audience of readers, and in addition to your book, I noted that you wrote about two seminal books about the region, one called River of Earth by James Still and Night Comes to the Cumberlands by Harry Caudill. What would people get in these books, and why do you think they're seminal works about Appalachia?
Well, there's a reason that when I was packing up my duffel bag and leaving the mothership in Louisville to travel out to Hazard, Kentucky to start my tenure as the Eastern Kentucky reporter, that the editors made sure that I had copies of those two books with me to read, which I read very quickly and was thankful that I did, because both in their own way really kind of help contextualize the 120 year history of the region since the first seam of coal was mined. River of Earth really illustrates what coal camp life was like, and the other really Night Comes to the Cumberlands talks about the generational poverty and those challenges. And even though that book was written half a century ago, there is still very much applicability to it. I got to cover James Still's memorial service when I was a reporter for the Courier Journal, and that was an amazing experience to see all the people who came out, who knew him, who loved his works. And yeah, I would, those books, along with Twilight and Hazard, if you want a trilogy about Eastern Kentucky, I would say those three books would be good starting points.
The Louisville Courier Journal closed the Eastern Kentucky Bureau in 2006. Is there any ongoing reliable reporting coming out of the region today?
One thing that I've seen in the past few weeks that has really pleased me is the citizen journalism that I've seen come out of the flooding. Some amazing on-the-ground reporting by non-traditional journalists who are not employed by a news organization, but who are writing essays, who are posting videos, who are doing amazing on-the-ground reporting. Unfortunately, in terms of news organizations, when the Courier Journal closed its bureau in 2006, it didn't fill it, and there's been a bit of a void ever since then. The former mayor of Hazard, when the Courier Journal shuttered its Eastern Kentucky Bureau, compared the importance of the Courier Journal to that of the Bible to people of the region. And I think that kind of sums up, you know, how important a voice the Courier Journal was in terms of keeping especially public officials accountable and honest.
Alan Maiman's book is called Twilight in Hazard, an Appalachian Reckoning. Thank you so much for an hour of your time and telling us more about the stories of the people in Eastern Kentucky.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.